Good morning. The topic we're going to speak about today, with a little bit more than a week left to Rosh Hashanah, is how Rosh Hashanah is a holiday of Emunah, a holiday where one of the themes that we're supposed to focus on is deepening our faith, our belief, and how the liturgy, the davening of Rosh Hashanah in particular, is really set up in order to enable us to do exactly that. For today, we have machzorim, the regular machzorim we have in the shul that are available. We'll be looking inside the machzor a little bit to help us try to understand the davening a little bit better, and how Be'ezus Hashem, that's going to help us really walk away from the yontif of Rosh Hashanah, hopefully with a deepening of the sense of emunah, which, as we'll see, is really so crucial to everything that we're doing on Rosh Hashanah. First, just a word about the davening in general. You know, it's a funny thing. If you ask most people what parts of the Rosh Hashanah davening are the most memorable, many people will tell you Unasana Tokef, Avinu Malkeinu. Again, I guess we could take a poll and figure out what most people would focus on. Most people would probably not focus on the various psukim that are usually rattled off by the chazan at rapid speed during the chazaras hashat of Musaf, the Malchiyos, the Chronos, and Shofros. At best, if there's a good song which is associated with one of those psukim, you know, Havein Yakir Li Ephraim, so then, okay, then we have fond memories of that particular part of the davening. But we're much more naturally drawn to things like Unasana Tokef, which frankly are very dramatic. The description of what's happening up in heaven by the Unasana Tokef, how only Tshuva, Tefillah, and Tzedakah can save us from the evil decree. These are things which are very dramatic and certainly pull on our heartstrings when we think about Rosh Hashanah and everything that it represents for us. Ironically, while not looking to put down any part of the davening, those poems, they're all piyutim, are all liturgical poems that were added later on during the Middle Ages. There are communities in Klal Yisrael that to this day do not say them. If you go to a Sephardi shul on Rosh Hashanah, they have no idea what you're talking about. If you speak about Unasana Tokef, even if you say Unatana Tokef, they'll still have no idea what you're talking about. It's just simply not part of the davening. And ironically, those parts of the davening which were set up by Chazal, by the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Gemara, in other words, parts of the davening which are essential, which were crucial to the davening, which if you don't say them on Rosh Hashanah, you didn't fulfill your obligation altogether, those we tend to kind of gloss over and not pay the adequate attention to them the way we should. So what we're going to try to do today is to look at some of those neglected parts of the davening Rosh Hashanah, which again, according to our rabbis, are really the essence, the critical part of our davening on Rosh Hashanah, try to appreciate them a little bit better, and try to show how by analyzing them and understanding them, hopefully we can deepen our Avodas Hashem, what we're supposed to be doing on the holiday of Rosh Hashanah. Yeah.
If, in fact, before we even get into them, these that are sort of rambled on,
yeah,
and they are truly supposedly the essence,
yeah,
why, in fact, in Chazaras Hashat, are they, in fact, just rambled on, and the Chashivas that is Magia Lam,
right,
is not there?
Right. So, congregational boredom, unfortunately. That's the simple answer. But hopefully by, you know, a little bit of today, at least the people here in the room together, you know, will have a heightened appreciation for them. And maybe if enough of us, you know, appreciate what's going on, maybe they'll start saying them, you know, with the chashivos that comes to them. You know, maybe this is a step in the right direction. Chazal tell us that there are three brachos which are added into the Musaf Shmona Esrei of Rosh Hashanah, which are unique to Rosh Hashanah. We don't say them any other time during the year. We'll actually see in a little bit that in theory there is another time during the year in which they could be recited, but our practice today is to only say them on Rosh Hashanah. Those are the three special brachos of Malchios, speaking about the sovereignty of God; Zichronos, speaking about how God remembers every human action and holds us accountable for them; and Shofros, tracing the idea that a shofar has played an important part in various different periods in Jewish history. Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros. Our rabbis also told us that the way those brachos are supposed to be composed is that there's an introductory part to each bracha, and then there are at least 10 psukim, 10 verses that are recited as part of the bracha, 3 psukim from the Chumash, 3 psukim from Tehillim, and then 3 psukim from the Nevi'im, concluding with one more pasuk from the Chumash itself. These 10 psukim are supposed to highlight the theme of each of the brachos and show how the theme of each of the brachos is connected to these psukim in Tanakh, is borne out through going through Tanakh. So if you go through Tanakh, you'll find 10 psukim at least that talk about how Hashem is the king, talk about how God remembers every action, and talks about the idea of the shofar. These brachos are so crucial to our davening on Rosh Hashanah that if one were to daven and omit the Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros, or omit the psukim, then one would not have properly fulfilled his obligation of davening on that day. What's the significance of these three brachos, these three themes of Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros? So here we turn to a very interesting statement that's made by Rav Yosef Albo, one of the great medieval Jewish philosophers, lived in the 1400s. Rav Yosef Albo writes that, in his opinion, the three brachos of Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros correspond to three pillars of Jewish belief. Rav Yosef Albo lived after the Rambam. The Rambam, as we know, codified all of Jewish belief into 13 principles, the 13 Ikarim, the 13 basic faith principles of the Rambam, the Ani Mamon, you know, as they're commonly known. Came Rav Yosef Albo, I guess, you know, it was an age of downsizing, and he said, you know, while I agree more or less with everything that the Rambam said, I don't think you have to make it into 13 principles. You can downsize those 13 principles into 3 basic principles of faith. And, you know, every belief that we have in Judaism can somehow be included in one of these three basic principles of faith. What are the three basic principles of faith of Judaism? Said Rav Yosef Albo, we believe that there's one God. We're monotheists, right? Unlike many other religions out there in the world that believe in multiple gods, or gods divided into different parts. You know, no, we believe in one God, and he's sovereign over the entire world. We believe in a concept known as schar ve'onesh, reward and punishment, that God holds us accountable for our actions. He's aware of every action that we do, and that for the mitzvahs we do, he's going to reward us for the averos that we do, for the sins that we're going to do. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to punish us, God forbid. And finally, there's a concept of revelation, that God revealed the Torah to us, and the Torah is our blueprint for everything we're supposed to do in life, right? These three basic principles, monotheism, the idea of providence, divine providence, and revelation, everything that we believe in Judaism can somehow be subcategorized under one of those basic pillars. I mean, for instance, so the Rambam writes, we believe in the coming of Mashiach. Mashiach is a subcategory of the idea of divine providence, of reward and punishment. We believe that Moshe Rabbeinu's nevuah, that his prophecy was unique. So that's a subcategory of the idea that God revealed the Torah to us, and through the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is different than the prophecy of all the other prophets, right? These three principles are the basic beliefs of Judaism. Just on a side note, as many of you know, I'm involved with Geirus, with conversions. So one of the things that we do as the person is just about to convert, we ask them to accept the basic beliefs of Judaism, and we outline exactly these three things. You know, we don't go through every single last detail of belief. That would take us a while. But, you know, in broad strokes, do you believe in the idea that there's one God? Do you believe in the idea that God gave us the Torah? Do you believe in the idea that God holds us accountable for our actions and will reward and punish us appropriately? If you believe that, in general strokes, you're in a good place. You have the basic concepts of what Jewish belief is all about. Says Rav Yosef Albo, these three concepts underlie the brachos of Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros, which we recite on Rosh Hashanah. And let's just go through it. It's, you know, once he lays it out for you, it makes perfect sense. What's Malchios? God is the king. What does it mean that God is the king? There's only one God. Because if there was more than one God, Chalila, it wouldn't be a monarchy. It would be some form of a democracy, a parliamentary government. This deity would say this. This deity would say that. The fact that it's a monarchy, right? That God is king, implies that there's only one God. That he's the we believe in a concept of monotheism. Zichronos is all about how God remembers every deed that we've done, and will hold us accountable for those deeds. That's the very essence of what Zichronos is all about. And Shofros, says Rav Yosef Albo, is about the concept of revelation. And here we need to do a little bit of explaining, because whereas Malchios is clearly about the idea of there being one God, and Zichronos is clearly about the idea of God having providence and rewarding and punishing us accordingly for our deeds, it's perhaps a little less obvious at first glance how Shofros is related to the idea of revelation. So on one simple level, as we'll see when we get to the Brach of Shofros, the Brach of Shofros starts off talking about the revelation of the Torah at Har Sinai. Ato yaradato banan kvodercho al am kodshich al adaber imam. You, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, came down in Har Sinai to speak to the Jewish people, to reveal to the Torah to them. And as we know, one of the things that's described when the Torah is given to the Jewish people is that vayhi kol hashofar holech v'chazak me'od. Right? There was this incredible shofar sound that was being blown at Har Sinai. Usually, I think when we try to picture the giving of the Torah in our minds, the shofar sound is kind of like background. In other words, if we try to visualize the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai, okay, so I don't know exactly how we visualized it, but the soundtrack in the back of the image of Har Sinai, okay, so there's the shofar going, okay, sounds good. Says Rav Yosef Albo, the shofar is more than that. The shofar is not just that the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to have a nice soundtrack for Matan Torah when he revealed the Torah at Har Sinai, but the very idea of the shofar always indicates that God is revealing himself and revealing something crucially important. That is the message of the shofar in a very fundamental sense. In fact, when we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, Rav Yosef Albo would tell us, the primary message of the shofar is God is saying, I am here. I am revealing myself. Right? As we know, there are various different explanations given for why we blow a shofar on Rosh Hashanah, what it's supposed to represent. One of the explanations is that just as a trumpet heralds the coming of the king, so too the shofar heralds the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is here, that he's imminent, that he's present with us. It seems like Rav Yosef Albo would understand shofar in general in that way. The main message of the shofar is to let us know God is in the process of revealing himself. So, the revelation... Okay.
You did something wrong.
I don't know. I think we need a shofar to put the lights back on. Okay. Hold on just a second.
Okay. We are back.
Okay. Again, as we were saying, the primary message of the shofar, according to Rabbi Yosef Albo, is to say Hashem is here. Hashem is revealing something about himself. He can't reveal all of himself, obviously, but something important about himself. The blowing of the shofar at Har Sinai is the sign of that imminence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he's right here at Har Sinai. And it's a sign of the fact that he's revealing something incredibly important, in this case, the Torah itself. Right? So we have these three ideas, Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros, Karis, you know, each one punctuated by the blowing of the shofar at the end. We blow the shofar at the end of each of these brachos. So they represent these three basic ideas of our emunah. If we take that idea and we just develop it a little bit, I think it's fair to say that according to Rav Yosef Albo, one of the things, or maybe even the most important thing that we're supposed to be thinking about on Rosh Hashanah, is how we can deepen our emunah and make it stronger. Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the year, right? What better way to start off the year than to think about how our emunah can be stronger than it currently is? And let's just take a moment and speak about the idea of emunah, right? Emunah usually translates as faith or belief. What exactly do we mean when we speak about emunah? So let's just pose the following question to kind of lead into this. Everybody knows the formula, ani ma'amin be'emunah shleima, right? I believe with perfect faith. What's the meaning of emunah shleima? You know, perfect faith. How do you have imperfect faith? And let me explain what I mean by the question, right? If faith were just a question of whether one believes in an intellectual proposition, then there's no such thing as perfect faith or imperfect faith or kind of faith or sort of faith. It's a certain proposition is either right or it's wrong. In other words, if you ask somebody, does 2 plus 2 equal 4? Yes, I believe that it does. Do you believe perfectly that 2 plus 2 equals 4? Do you believe sort of that 2 plus 2 equals 4? The question is a non-starter, because it's basically just a question of either yeah or no. Right? In other words, either this fact is true, I believe it to be true, or I believe it not to be true. Is it raining outside? No. Right? Do you believe with perfect faith that it's not raining outside? Again, it's a little bit of a silly question. It's just an intellectual proposition. Either you believe in it or you don't believe in it. That's not really what we mean when we speak about emunah. Emunah has at least two levels to it. Of course, on one level, emunah is about an intellectual proposition. A person says, I believe that there is one God. But emunah is much more than that. Emunah is the person feeling, so to speak, in their kishkas, that there is one God. Not just as an intellectual proposition. Yeah, you know, if you ask me, you know, to give me a survey, check off the box, do you believe in monotheism, polytheism, dualism, you know, whatever, you know. No, I check off the monotheism box. No, okay, that's true. That is the right box to check off. But emunah is so much more than that. Emunah means that I walk around during the day with a consciousness that there's one God. I walk around with an awareness that there's one God. Or to take another example, right? The idea of Tzar Va'onash. God rewards us and punishes us according to our actions. Do we believe in that? So, as an intellectual proposition, it's easy for us to check off the box and say, yes, I believe that God will reward us for our mitzvos and punish us for our aveiros. When you're faced with an aveira that looks really good and really tempting, I'll let you fill in your mind's eye whatever that avera happens to be. I don't want to give anybody any ideas. But when a person is faced with such an avera, the fact that on an intellectual level they've checked off, I believe that God will hold us accountable for our actions, may or may not translate into that feeling in your kishkas that, you know, I there's no way I could do this avera because God is watching, right? There's a famous story with the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was traveling with in a wagon with Bal Agola, you know, the coachman who's you know, at the head of the wagon driving it, and they're all alone, and you know, in the middle of some you know, some farmland in the middle of the middle of Lithuania somewhere. And the Bal Agola, the wagoneer, sees that there's some some grain, you know, which has been gathered together on the side of a certain field, and it seems totally abandoned, and it looks like there's no one around for miles and miles. So the wagoneer pulls over the wagon, tells the Chafetz Chaim, tells the Chafetz Chaim, could you just wait here for a minute? I have something to take care of. Goes over to the bundle of grain, picks it up, and throws it into the back of his wagon. And the Chafetz Chaim starts yelling. He says, "They're watching! They're watching!" So the wagoneer gets very nervous. Quickly, you know, whistles a little bit, takes the bundle of grain, throws it back, you know, onto the side of the field, you know, and gallops out of there. So half a mile down the road, he turns to the Chafetz Chaim and says, "By the way, who was watching? I really didn't see anybody." So Chafetz Chaim says, "You know, the one above was watching." So, you know, I'm sure if you'd have asked the wagoneer, "Do you believe that there's a God who holds us accountable for all of our actions? Do you believe in the idea of Schar Va'onesh?" I'm sure he would have checked off the box. But Emunah is much more than checking off the box. Emunah is having that feeling inside of us, so when we're faced with temptation, we know that we're supposed to do the right thing, and we actually go ahead and do that which is right. Right, so that's coming back to the idea of Emunah Shlema. How can we talk about having complete faith, perfect faith, and how do you distinguish that from imperfect faith? So imperfect faith means I believe in the intellectual proposition. That's Emunah. Emunah Shlema means that I've made that a part of who I am. What we're supposed to be doing on Rosh Hashanah is, through our recitation of Malchus, the Chronos and Shofros, deepening that emunah within us and trying to make it not only an emunah but an emunah shlema. And in the schus, in the merit of that, we hope to be judged favorably on the Yom HaDin. I should point out an interesting fact, which again I think speaks to this idea as well. The Mishnayos tell us that there was one other time when we would daven Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros, and it was not on Rosh Hashanah. Say the Mishnayos in Rosh Hashanah that when they would blow the shofar on Yom Kippur of Yovel, right? We know that, again, once upon a time in Eretz Yisrael, every 50 years was observed as the Yovel, as the Jubilee year. There were all kinds of repercussions to Yovel. The slaves would go free, land would return to its original owners, the land lay fallow as it does during a Shemitah year. And on Yom Kippur of the Yovel year, the shofar would be blown, signifying the fact that it was now the Yovel year. By the way, that's one of the explanations behind the custom that we have to blow shofar at the very end of Yom Kippur. It's supposed to be reminiscent, according to some, of the fact that the shofar was blown once upon a time every 50 years on the Yovel year. Say the Mishnayos in Rosh Hashanah, when they would blow the shofar on Yom Kippur of Yovel, that year they would also daven on Musaf of Yom Kippur, Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros. It was a very long davening, that Yom Kippur. Right, they had to pay the chazan a little bit extra, you know, to put in all these extra brachos. Why is that? Why would Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros, which we usually think of as being a Rosh Hashanah davening, why would that be connected to Yovel? And I think perhaps the answer is that Yovel, like Rosh Hashanah, has elements of restoring our faith, restoring our emunah. B'shnas ha-Yovel azos toshuvu yishal achuzoso. In the Yovel year, everything goes back to its original source. And we as well are supposed to go back to our source of emunah and strengthen it. So we blow shofar, we have Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros, because that same theme of strengthening emunah, which we have on Rosh Hashanah, is present during the Yom Kippur of a Yovel year in that way as well. Right? So again, the idea of Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros being tied in to strengthening emunah, I think fits well with the fact that we would say these brachos on a Yovel year, even though it was not Rosh Hashanah. What I wanted to take a look at over the next couple of minutes is the actual text of some of the Malchus, Zichronos, and Shofros, particularly to focus on the psukim which are recited. Again, as we said, the psukim tend to be given short shrift, but I think if we really look at the psukim and understand what the Machzor is trying to convey to us, it will be a different Rosh Hashanah for us, Be'ezus Hashem. So, with that in mind, if you have a Machzor, on page 506 is the opening paragraph of the Malchios. We have a few more Machzorim over here. The Malchus start off with a paragraph which is familiar to us, the second paragraph of Aleinu. Al kei nekave lecha Hashem Elokeinu, liros mehera b'sifaras uzecha. Right? The paragraph that speaks about how one day all of the nations of the world are going to throw away their idols and their idolatry. They will all recognize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the only king. And that paragraph quotes the first of the psukim in Chumash. It's four lines from the end of that paragraph. Kakosuv b'sara secha, as it says in your Torah, Hashem yimloch la'olam va'ed. God will be the king forever and ever. Right? So that's the basic pasuk in Chumash that states the idea that God not only is king now, but we look forward to some kind of future where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be accepted as king by the entire world. Then we quote two other psukim that also come from Chumash that speak about God being a king. V'nemar, it says, this is a pasuk uttered by Bilam HaRasha when he sought to curse the Jewish people but ended up blessing them. Lo hibit oven b'Yaakov v'lo ra'a amal b'Yisrael. God did not see any sins or iniquity in the Jewish people. Hashem Elokav imo, Hashem, his God, Israel's God, is with them. Ustruas melech bo. The word trua, which of course you're talking about, you're giving a Rosh Hashanah shiur, you say trua, oh, that means a blast, right? Trua in this context means friendship. Like the word reus. Ustruas melech bo, the friendship of the king is with Klal Yisrael. V'nemar, and another pasuk, which is, you know, the Machzor here quotes what they sing at weddings. Vayhi v'shurin melech b'saseif roshei om yachad shiftei Yisrael. Okay, that where you get excited. Weddings, okay, that's a nice thing, right? God was king in Yeshurun amidst the Jewish people. B'saseif roshei om, when the leaders of the people assembled, yachad shiftei Yisrael, and the tribes of Israel came together. Okay, three psukim that talk about Hashem being melech. What's so exciting about that? What are we supposed to take away from the fact that you can find three psukim in Chumash that describe God as being a melech? You know, if you have this they used to have a handy-dandy book called a concordancia, a concordance. Then they came out with this handy-dandy thing called a computer, and it made all the concordances obsolete, right? But, you know, because now if you want to find where it says melech in Chumash, you type in the word melech into the computer, it could tell you every single place, you know, in any single sefer where the word melech appears. Okay, so we find three places in Chumash where it talks about the idea of Hashem being a melech. Why is it so important to quote this psukim? You know, just to show off that, you know, the one who put the Machzor together could quote a lot of psukim. The last two of these three psukim emphasize an idea which is subtle, but when we think about it, we'll see is in the psukim in a very, very real way. God is our king, that's true, but he's not an authoritarian king. He's a king who has authority, but he's a king with whom we have a loving relationship, not simply a relationship where he rules over us against our will. In a sense, the relationship we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be compared to a good parent-child relationship, or a good teacher-student relationship, or for that matter, a good employer-employee relationship. Clearly, that's the relationship which is not a balanced one, right? In other words, if the parent and the child enjoy equal rights, so that's usually a recipe for disaster. If the employer and the employee are on equal footing, you know, I'd like you to get in this report by Tuesday. Well, I'd rather not get in the report by Tuesday. Okay, you know, look, you know, let's put it to a vote, right? You know, if they're on equal footing, so that's a recipe for disaster. On the other hand, if the subordinate in all of these relationships feels that they're just being pushed around, and that the, you know, the superior, you know, be it the parent, the teacher, the employer, you know, is just making the inferior, quote unquote, party to the relationship do whatever they want without any regard for their well-being, that's not going to be a healthy relationship either. The relationship has to be one where there's an authority without being authoritarian. Look in these two psukim, and that's how HaKadosh Baruch Hu is described as being the Melech. Hashem Elokav Imo. Hashem, the God of the Jewish people, is with them. And then the most striking phrase, Usruas Melech Bo. The friendship of the king is with the Jewish people. Those two words, friendship and king, you wouldn't really think go together. If God is my king, how can he be my friend? And the answer is, it's a complex relationship. It's what a good parent-child relationship is supposed to be. Your parent is not just supposed to be your boss. The parent is supposed to be, on some level, your friend. But in the terminology of today, the parent is not supposed to be your BFF either. The parent is supposed to be an authority figure. The parent is supposed to be able to tell you what to do. And you're supposed to listen to the parent at the end of the day. But if the child feels that the parent just is bossing me around, you know, without any regard for my well-being, that's also not going to be healthy. Truas melech bo. God is our king, but at the same time, he's also our friend. Because we accept HaKadosh Baruch Hu as willingly as being the king over us. The same idea is in the next pasuk, Vayhi v'yishurun melech. Right? God was the king, v'yishurun. Yishurun is another word for the Jewish people. He was the king among the Jewish people. Now, the truth is, if I was composing the pasuk and I wanted to express the idea that God is the king for the Jews, I would say that God was the king over Yeshurun. Right? Not that he was the king amidst Yeshurun. He was the king over Yeshurun. He lorded over the Jewish people, literally. Vayihi al Yeshurun melech. But that's not what it says. Vayihi v'yishurun melech. This asif rashi yom yachad shivtei Yisrael. All of the Jewish people came together, and kivyochol, as it were, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is at the party together with us. Again, occupying a very different role. He's not our equal. But we feel that he's with us. He's not some distant monarch who makes up rules and then forces us to follow them. He's the Yeshurun. He's amidst the Jewish people. So in a very subtle way, these psukim from Chumash convey an idea about God's Malchus, which, you know, requires us to think a little bit beneath the surface. The kind of emunah that we want to have in God is not just this abstract notion that, yeah, there's that king out there somewhere, right? That, yes, I believe in the abstract notion that God created a world and that he runs it all by himself. That's true. But I also want to get to this idea of truas melech bo, that God is my king and my friend. And I have that kind of dual relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Were it not for the pasuk, I wouldn't quite feel that idea. Now, let's take that idea and move on a little bit, because we then have three psukim that come from Tehillim. Uva divrei kodshecha kasuv leimor. Ki lashem hamelucha umoshel bagoyim. Sovereignty is Hashem's, and he rules over the nations. There's a fascinating idea from the Vilna Gaon that relates to this pasuk, and it brings out in sharp relief the idea we were talking about a moment ago about God being not only our king but our friend. Says the Vilna Gaon, this pasuk uses two words that describe the royalty, the sovereignty of Hashem. Ki Lashem HaMelucha, right? Melucha, sovereignty. Umoshel Bagoyim, and he rules over all the nations. Says the Vilna Gaon, you should understand there's a difference between a melech and a moshel. Melech means king, moshel means ruler. But the terms convey, they connote something very different from one another. Melech, says the Vilna Gaon, is the king who rules with the consent of the people. Moshel is an overlord who basically rules like a despot, who rules against the will of the people. Says the Vilna Gaon, the Pasuk is telling us that God has right now has a very different relationship with the Jewish people versus his relationship with the rest of the world. Ki lashem hamelucha, vis-a-vis the Jewish people, God is a melech. As we said before, he's our king whom we love as a friend. We accept him willingly. Umoshel bagoyim. But when it comes to the nations of the world, God is, right now, God is a Moshel. He rules over them with an iron hand, with an iron fist. God, vis-a-vis those nations who do not accept him as being God, as being their ruler, to them, right now in history, he's, as in a certain sense, a despot. And as someone who's ruling over them against their will, against what they really want. That's the way things stand as of now. And that idea of God establishing himself, perhaps against the will of many of the inhabitants of the earth, is brought out of the next pasuk, the Ne'emar, Hashem Moloch Geyus Lovesh. God rules, so to speak, he is wearing Geyus. Geyus here in the English they translate as grandeur. I would say it's a little, Geyus is a little bit stronger than that even. Geyus is related to the word gaiva, pride, right? God rules over the world with a sense of pride and we might say entitlement. That's not a lovey-dovey image of the Ribbono Shel Olam. God rules over the world with strength. Lovesh Hashem owes his hazor. And the pasuk goes on to say exactly that. God girds himself, kivyochol, with strength, with power. Aftikon tevel baltimot. He sets up the world such that it's not going to falter. God's a boss. He rules over the world and nobody questions him. That's vis-a-vis the rest of the world, the non-Jewish world. Right now, that's the state of affairs, as emphasized in these two psukim. But then comes, again, a very interesting citation, which when you read it, okay, it's nice, it's fine, we all know these psukim, let's move on. But when we understand what these psukim are doing, they clue us into what we're supposed to be thinking about as we go through the Malchus. The Ne'emar, it says, Se'usha arim oshechem v'inasu piskayolam v'yabo melech hakavod. Raise up your heads, O gates, be uplifted, you everlasting entrances, so that the King of Glory may enter. Who is this King of Glory? Hashem the Mighty and Strong, Hashem the Strong in Battle. Raise up your heads, O gates, and raise up, you everlasting entrances, so that the King of Glory may enter. Who is the King of Glory? Hashem, Master of Legions. He is the King of Glory, Selah. Four psukim, right? We're familiar to us from Tehillim, from Perek Chof Dalet, right? We say when we put back the Sefer Torah, except on Shabbos morning. Being that we only have to quote three psukim from Tehillim, how come we quoted what comes out to be six psukim? Right? I mean, we could have just quoted the last pasuk over here. Mihu ze melech hakavod, Hashem tzvakos, ze melech hakavod tzela. It mentions the idea of God being melech twice. So why quote the whole section of these four psukim that are contiguous with one another? What's added by bringing the whole section? Here said Rav Soloveitchik the following beautiful idea. He said, if you look at the psukim themselves, there are two descriptions of how the gates are opening up and allowing God to come in as the King of Glory. We first say, Se'usha arim roshechem, v'hinasu pischei olam. It's Sunday morning, we're not going to get too much into Hebrew grammar, but for those who have fond or perhaps dreaded memories of Dikduk, v'hinasu is passive. be lifted up, you gates. Right? You gates, allow yourselves to be lifted up and let the King of Glory come in. Two psukim later we read, Se'usha arim asheichem, u'se'u pischei olam. You gates, lift yourselves up. Don't allow yourselves to be passively lifted by someone else. Lift yourselves up and allow the King of Glory, Hashem, to come in. So as Rav Soloveitchik, the psukim are describing a transition in the way the gates themselves relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, described as the King coming in through the gates. The first time the gates are lifted up, meaning they don't do it themselves, they are acted upon. I don't want to open up. I'm not in a muto. Who is this King anyway? Alright, if I'm forced to open up, the gate says I'll open up. But then, Se'u pischei olam, the gate realizes, you know, it's worthwhile for me to open up. This is a great King who's coming in. I accept the King willingly. So the gate, instead of just being opened up by others, so to speak, the gate opens itself up of its own volition and allows the Ribbono Shel Olam to come in. This phenomena which we see with the gates, says Rav Soloveitchik, is really indicative of the way the nations of the world are going to come around to accepting HaKadosh Baruch Hu as being King. Initially, from their perspective, it's going to be v'hinasu pischei olam. Allow yourselves to be lifted up. God's our King, I guess so. If he forces us, I guess we'll accept him as King. But the day will come where se'u she'arim o'sheichem u'se'u pischei olam. The gates will open themselves up. And the nations of the world, correspondingly, will open themselves up as well, and will recognize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is truly God of their own volition. They won't have to be forced into it. They will no longer see Hashem as the Moshel. They will see Him instead as being the Melech. He won't be the overlord. He'll be the King. And they'll develop that truas Melech, that friendship of the King, which we the Jewish people have. So it was necessary to quote these four psukim in order to show that transition. And when we get to the third part of Malchus, where we quote three psukim from the Nevi'im, that's exactly what we see with regard to the psukim from the Nevi'im. The psukim from the Nevi'im all speak about the messianic future when all of the nations are going to come to recognize Hashem as God. Ko amar Hashem melech Yisrael v'go'alo. God right now is recognized as the King of Israel. Ani rishon v'ani acharon v'balodai ein Elohim. Everyone will recognize that besides me there is no God. Right? There will be saviors who will come and judge Har Esav, right? The mountain of Esav. In other words, the non-Jewish world which rejects HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be judged at that time. And at that time, God will have melucha, which again, remember, according to the Vilna Gaon, means he will be accepted as the King universally. V'nemar v'hoyo Hashem lemelech al kol ha'aretz v'yomahu yi Hashem echad u'shmo echad. God will be melech over the entire world. That which previously had been just the province of the Jewish people is now going to be accepted by everybody. And now the crescendo spoke, so to speak. U'v'soros ka'kos of lemar, in your Torah it says Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem echad. What's that pasuk doing here? I mean, it's a beautiful pasuk, don't get me wrong. Shema Yisrael, you know, it's very nice. Right? But we're quoting psukim that speak about Hashem as being the Melech, the King. So why is Shema Yisrael here? I mean, last I checked, there's no mention of Melech in the pasuk Shema Yisrael. So here it would seem that the Machzor is referencing Rashi and Chumash. Right? It's a good Rashi and Chumash to know. Rashi says, what does it mean, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad? I mean, we say it every day. So Miami Boys made a song out of this. It must be true. But if you look, Rashi, on Chumash writes, what's the meaning of Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad? Shema Yisrael, listen, O Israel, Hashem Shehu Elokeinu Ata, Hashem, who right now is recognized by us, the Jewish people, alone as being God, Hashem Echad, Hashem will be recognized as the only God in the future when Mashiach comes, by the entire world. So, in other words, according to Rashi's interpretation, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad really crystallizes everything we've been talking about throughout Malchus. Right now, we the Jewish people acknowledge Hashem as the only sovereign, as the only God, but we believe with all of our hearts that the day will come where the entire world will come to that recognition as well. Hashem Shehu Elokeinu Ata, Hashem who is our God right now, will be recognized as Hashem Echad. He will be the only God recognized as such by the entire world when Mashiach comes eventually. It's the perfect way to end off this bracha of Malchus with everything that it represents. In the interest of time, I just want to share a little bit about Shofros, because there's a concept in Shofar which I think is worthwhile bringing out, you know, before we break for today. So again, we quoted Rav Yosef Albo as saying that the Shofar is the instrument that represents God's revelation. Whenever we blow Shofar, whenever we hear Shofar, so some kind of revelation is being made to us. If you look in the Bracha of Shofros on page 516, so the first three psukim which are quoted there are all psukim about Matan Torah and how the shofar was sounding and blowing at Matan Torah. That fits in beautifully, you know, with the idea of shofar representing revelation. But if we turn to page 518 and look at the second paragraph, I'm going to skip the middle paragraph for a moment. The second paragraph there, which is the citations from Nevi'im, speak about how the shofar is going to be blown when Mashiach comes. Kol yoshvei sevel v'shochnei oretz kinsonei sfarim tiro v'chizkoa shofar tishmo. When the shofar is blown by Mashiach, the entire world is going to recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'ne'mar v'hoyo b'yom ahu. This is also a song, so everybody knows it. Yitoka b'shofar gadol uvo ha'ovdim b'eretz Ashur v'nidochim b'eretz Mitzrayim shtachbu l'Hashem b'arakodesh b'Yerushalayim. Again, the shofar is associated with the coming of Mashiach. So too for the third pasuk, which is quoted there, v'Hashem aleihem yeira'eh v'Hashem elokim b'shofar yiska. God is going to blow a great shofar at the time of Mashiach. Why is the shofar blowing when Mashiach comes? You know, you got to wonder, right? There's this idea, which, again, we all grew up with, that the shofar is going to be blown when Mashiach comes. I don't know, now that we're living in 2016, almost 2017, wouldn't it be more efficient to just send a text? You know, Mashiach is here. Wouldn't people be more likely to check their texts than to listen to a shofar? Probably, right? So, isn't this a little bit outdated, the idea with the shofar blowing? What's supposed to be represented by the shofar being blown? The answer is, according to Rav Yosef Albo, the shofar is not just an instrument to get everybody's attention. I mean, how would you blow a shofar that would be heard around the world anyway? The shofar is the sign of God's revelation. God reveals the Torah, the shofar blows. God reveals the coming of Mashiach and all of the, you know, the new knowledge that's going to spread around the world when Mashiach comes. That's also an opportunity for the blowing of the shofar. Right? Shofar always means God's revealing something new and showing his presence, his imminence, you know, be it by Matan Torah, be it by the blowing of the shofar. With that in mind, take a look back at the top paragraph on 518. Uvedivrei kodshecha kostov leimor olo elokim bistru Hashem b'kol shofar. V'nemar b'chatzotzros v'kol shofar haril f'nei ha'melech Hashem v'nemar tiku v'chodesh shofar b'kesel liyom chagenu ki chok liyisohu mishpot l'elokei Yaakov. If the first paragraph of shofar spoke about the blowing of shofar at Har Sinai, and the last paragraph speaks about the blowing of shofar at the coming of Mashiach, so what is the occasion of the blowing of shofar in the middle paragraph? And the answer is right now. In our own world, tiku v'chodesh shofar. Right? What's tiku v'chodesh shofar? Blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Right? The holiday that begins at the beginning of the month, tiku v'chodesh shofar. In other words, the bracha is telling us that if we put our minds to it, the very same level of revelation that we had at Matan Torah and that we will have when Mashiach comes, we can get some of that by hearing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. We're not going to fully, be in the space of Matan Torah or fully be in the space of Bias Mashiach, but part of that recognition of the imminence and the presence of God, we can feel when we come to Shul or we hear shofar elsewhere on Rosh Hashanah. We should feel, and we can feel, if we work on ourselves enough, we can imagine in our mind's eye that we are at Har Sinai, or we are listening to the shofar at the coming of Mashiach. It's an interesting exercise. When they blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, try closing your eyes. And I find oftentimes when I'm in shul and I look out, I see many people have closed their eyes. They're probably going through this exercise. Right? Listen, when you listen to the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, just close your eyes. And in your mind's eye, imagine that you're at Har Sinai, or that, you've just gotten the news that Mashiach has come, and that feeling of, wow, I am close to Hashem, which you feel at that moment, then open up your eyes, realize you're back in Shul, and say, you know what? I can capture something of that feeling even now. You know, it's not Har Sinai, it's not the coming of Mashiach, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence can be felt just listening to the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. I have the power within myself, through my emunah, to come to that point. So much of emunah involves a certain degree of imagination. Right? The exercise we just described, imagining that one is in a certain situation, in a certain environment, and using that to strengthen our emunah, our sense of being close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is an exercise that can be used over and over again on Rosh Hashanah as we daven. Davening, after all, on some level is an exercise in imagination, taking ourselves away from the world which surrounds us with all of its worries and its sorrows and whatnot, and at least carving out a small amount of time for ourselves to be together with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that sense of true Asmelech. Hashem is not only our King, but He's our friend as well. There's a lot more to talk about. I've just really given a little bit of the surface of as how we can go through what seemed to be not inspiring psukim, if you can say such a thing, but we can really realize that the psukim are the key to understanding what our emunah obligations are on Rosh Hashanah, how we can deepen that emunah, and Be'ezus Hashem, we should come into Rosh Hashanah, and experience Rosh Hashanah as a holiday in which our emunah soars, that we feel ourselves with that sense of tremendous connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and in that sense, we should be zocha to Aksiva V'Chasima Tova.